Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, as always, Bill Wirtz, and you're listening to episode 148 on March 14, 2024. As a note, I will be back moderating panels at BTC Prague 2024, the biggest Bitcoin-only conference in Europe, maybe even the world. That will be happening on June 13 to 15 this year in Prague, in the Czech Republic, at PVA Expo. You can find info by just typing in BTC Prague, and then you will find btcprague.com. And with promo code BILL, B-I-L-L, you'll get 10% off your order there at the tickets for BTC Prague. They have different tickets, expo tickets, industry pass tickets, conference tickets for all your different needs. And of course, you can pay on Bitcoin as well. And you'll be able to hear me moderate a very exciting panel on both the main stage and the expo stage there at BTC Prague. So I think I'm attending 2 days out of the 4 day conference there, or the 4 day events. So yeah. Show up and hopefully we can meet up and explore the world of Bitcoin there in Prague. My guest this week is Jorge Teixeira. He's a parliamentary assistant for Iniciativa Liberal, a political party in Portugal. And he commented on the parliamentary election in Portugal last Sunday and what we can expect to happen from here on out in the coalition talks. You'll hear the entire exchange at the end of this episode. Also in this episode, consumers reject the ban on the internal combustion engine, Romanians donate more blood due to meal voucher program, and ongoing strikes in German rail are upsetting consumers. So let's get started with this first story. As you know, the European Union has decided that from 2035 on, the internal combustion engine, that means all cars using petrol and diesel, will be illegal for sale. But that rule is up for reconsideration in 2026. So with a new European Parliament and a slightly changed European Council, that ban could be reconsidered. According to reporting by Euractiv, surveys show that voters in Germany, Poland, and France consider a ban on the internal combustion engine to be their least favorite climate policy. Among 15,000 respondents, a ban on the ICE ranked amongst the least preferred climate policies, followed by CO2 taxes and road tolls, with the exception for electric cars. Most notably, as I write on the blog of the Consumer Champs website, most notably, the measure also finds overwhelming rejection in the voting blocs of political parties that, on a European level, support it, including center-left parties such as Germany's SPD, Poland's Lewica, and France's Parti Socialiste. The Consumer Champs survey is something that we'll get into in next week's episode. My colleague Zoltan Case has been working on a survey of all the candidates for the European elections in June, so we'll be talking about that further in that episode. Consumers need to be the driver of market supply. While there is a need for sustainable solutions, as I write on this blog, outright bans contradict consumer choice and are not technologically neutral. Vehicles with the internal combustion engine have reduced their petrol consumption considerably over the last decades, which is a direct response to consumer demand for lower running costs of operating their vehicles. This has done more for the environmental sustainability of individual transport than government measures. Those consumers who choose electric vehicles remain free to do so, but should not be privileged over other consumers, especially because their vehicles often are more accessible to higher income households compared to traditional vehicles. From an economic standpoint, the EU would also penalize its own manufacturing industry in favor of markets in Asia and North America. So it seems that this measure is not particularly popular, as this survey that Euractiv reported on shows. And I think it's a good indicator, a good vector to show where we're going in these European elections. Climate is at the top of the list, but not in the same way it was in 2019. Next up, we have news out of Romania reported on by Euronews.
Blood stocks in Romania have hit new highs thanks to a huge increase in the value of meal vouchers given to donors. In January, it went from the equivalent of around 13 euros per ticket to 56 euros. Donation centres are now constantly full, with people sometimes queuing for hours to give blood.
So this is definitely one of the good news type elements of this podcast. Blood donations are up in Romania, and that is also due to a meal voucher system. So they increased the amount that you will be receiving for those meal vouchers, which I assume are probably to be used in grocery stores and restaurants. So very interesting how Romania has definitely been upping their numbers on blood donations. Well, across Europe, there's often shortages, and for specific crises, people are called upon to donate blood. But often they don't really receive anything in return. Most European countries actually rely on voluntary, non-remunerated blood and plasma donors. So plasma donors actually paid for their donations in 4 countries in Europe: Austria, Germany, Czech Republic, and Hungary. Also in the United States, Ukraine, China, and some others also do pay for those donations. This is actually something we worked on in the past in Canada, paid blood plasma donations. And it's something that is incredibly valuable, because when you have a shortage but you expect people to just do it voluntarily, you don't get the amount of that you need, and then we do have shortages. I don't think there's anything wrong with remunerating people for it. They take time out of their day. Maybe they take time off work. And in many countries, all they do is get a chocolate cookie or a croissant. So it does absolutely make sense to boost those supply numbers by paying people for it. So yeah, if that's a meal voucher, then why not? So good on you, Romania. Another story is the strike on German rail, which has now been ongoing and actually extended also to airports. So there's quite some travel disruption once again in Germany. Deutsche Welle writes, German train drivers to strike after court motion fails. A German labor court in Frankfurt ruled against an urgent application filed by Germany's national rail operator Deutsche Bahn on Monday that had attempted to stop a renewed strike action by GDL Train Drivers Union. The company had argued that a reduced notice period ahead of the strike announced on Sunday evening and starting as early as Monday was unreasonable. The strike was not disproportionate to the circumstances, ruled Frankfurt judge Stephanie Lenz on Monday evening. And then we also have an interesting story out of the German newspaper Zeit, which says 5 months of collective bargaining, more than 200 hours of strike action in total, even a federal transport minister can react a little disgruntled. So striking instead of entering into negotiations is irresponsible. That says Volker Wissing from the Liberal FDP party, which is part of the current governing coalition in Germany. And Zeit also writes, if you look at the figures, the parties no longer seem so far apart. Deutsche Bahn recently showed itself to be open to gradually reducing the working week for train drivers, train attendants, and workshop employees to 38 to 36 hours. That is only 1 hour more than GDL is demanding. Nevertheless, Klaus Weselski is not satisfied. That is the trade union boss here. Financial pressure may also get things moving. The labor dispute is expensive for both sides. Deutsche Bahn estimates its own economic losses per day of strike action at 25 million euros. There's also a risk that freight customers will permanently shift their logistics to the road, but GDL also has to look at the money. It pays its members 10 euros per hour if they take part in the industrial action, up to maximum 100 euros per day. If thousands of union members are constantly on strike, even a well-fitted strike fund is quickly emptied. So this has caused quite a ruckus, and of course politicians are reacting to it, and should be again an indicator that we need more competition on the rail. Germany has practiced this model of some private competition by commissioning out regional train connections to small private operators. And the only real competition is through state actors from on border routes and Flixbus, which operates FlixTrain successfully and is often used by travelers, especially at a moment in time where Deutsche Bahn is not only on strike but also has to do considerable renovations on the rail network in Germany, which is something that we discussed on the podcast before and is something that is definitely not making taking the train in Germany a pleasure. I've done it many times. I am not a fan of Deutsche Bahn. But that private offer is just not available. And as we get to further rail liberalization in the European Union, I think the trade unions will have to sort of consider their options, because when consumers have too much of a choice, then maybe the companies, when consumers have more of a choice, let's say, than the companies, will probably not be as forgiving with the demands of those unions, because they are not the sole operators. Now let's move to the interview of the week. My guest this week is Jorge Teixeira. He's a political advisor at Iniciativa Liberal, a political party in Portugal. And we're talking about the election results of the Portuguese election that was on Sunday. It saw big losses for the incumbent Socialist Party, which does not get an absolute majority anymore. Neither do their affiliated partners. The center-right Democratic Alliance, however, also does not secure an outright absolute majority, so it will come to either coalition building or maybe even a minority government, and that's something we discussed here with Jorge, so take it away. Jorge, thank you so much for joining the Consumer Podcast. It's very good to have somebody on who can help us sort of understand what happened in these Portuguese elections. But I think it's important to also point out that you were running yourself in this election. So what can you tell us about your result and your experience on the campaign trail?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be back here at the EU Consumer Podcast, Bill. And about the election, so a lot has changed since the last talk we had. We had a talk about the privatization of TAP, I think a year or so ago, a little less than a year ago. And as you can see now, we just had elections, and you know, the context, the political context in Portugal has changed a lot. So about me, so I'm an advisor in Parliament for the initiative, for the Liberal Initiative Party. And I remain an advisor. I wasn't elected. I was running for the Setúbal district. We have in Portugal the electoral system involves several different districts with that elect a number of MPs depending on their population. We have 230 MPs in Parliament. My district, which is the Setúbal district, elects 19 MPs. I was number two on the Liberal Initiative list. I wasn't elected. I'm a bit closer to that result now. We had around 26,000 votes. We had 22,000 votes in the last election. And our estimation is that we need around 38,000-39,000 votes in order to get a second MP. But I wouldn't say that my non-election is the most interesting outcome of this election, as you would suppose.
No, I didn't want to ask. I didn't want to ask about you first before we get into it. I think the first push notification I received was that there was a lot more participation in this election, above average. I mean, it was 65%. I think of Portuguese people eligible to vote went to the polls. We've discussed in our previous episode sort of why that could be, because a lot has happened. Can you sort of like tell us here, what do these results tell us? Because what we see is an incumbent government being penalized, but what I don't see is a real winner either. So can you run that through for us?
So actually, the two main parties in Portugal just had some of their worst results historically. I don't think these were their absolute worst results. Our democracy has been running since the 70s. But I would say in something like the last 30 years, they had their worst result. And what happens is, so I have two theories about the behavior of voters and voter turnout in this election. So just to give you an idea, we had the best turnout since 95. In the absolute number of votes, this was the most participated election ever, you know, because of population growth since the 70s. So this is what happened. I have two theories. So I was never a fearmonger about low turnouts in contemporary democracies. I think there are reasons for that why it happens. And one of them is people need to feel like the election is actually going to determine what's going to happen in the country. And right now we had a very polarized election. A lot is on the table, and we also have more options in the ballot than ever, or actually more viable options in the ballot than ever. Our parliament is getting quite fragmented. We have a lot of political parties in parliament. I think that stimulates turnout. I think that's a positive outcome. And on the other hand, there is this studied phenomenon across many countries in Europe that the radical right actually pulls people out from, you know, puts people in voting. And if we look at turnout patterns across the country, we can see that some of the places where turnout had the biggest increase were also places where Chega, the radical right party, had their best result. So I think we can establish a correlation between these. I think it's a good thing that people participate. What we have to evaluate from now on is whether these are people who will go back into non-voting in case they're dissatisfied with Chega, or whether they will remain politically active in the next years, and whether they can be captured by other parties.
Yeah, Chega is definitely an interesting phenomenon that is, you know, we can sort of see in other countries as well. What it sort of reminds me of as a fragment, as you point out, this fragmentation is a bit of an Italian model. In Italy, you have multiple parties on the right and the left, and the decision that will come out of these coalition talks that we'll eventually have is, it is up to the center right party to decide whether they want to go for this grand coalition, as has been the case in Germany on several occasions, or whether they will choose to find their alliance on the right. And I think that could be quite determinative for the future as well, because then the left fragmentation and the right fragmentation will try and ping pong off of each other in the future. Is that something you see as well, that sort of the Italization of Portuguese politics could happen here?
I would say that Portugal is in a defining moment right now. And the choices of the two main parties will be quite determining of our political system for the next decade or so, or even more than our next decade. I don't know what's going to happen. The elections were 2 days ago. But from the signs I've been seeing, the winner, AD, or the coalition, the main center-right coalition that won the election, is trying to go at it alone. And then they're going to pressure both the PS and Chega to, you know, to pass the budget. And they're going to try to negotiate, you know, different policies and different budgets, you know, on a piecemeal basis, and pressure both parties to let their policies pass. In our case, for the Liberal Initiative, we're willing to collaborate with the PSD, which is the main party in the winning coalition. We can work closely with them, and our perspective is that right now the government needs to show ambition and willingness to reform as quickly as possible, so they can prove to voters that they're actually the real deal. If we get like this stagnated, unambitious, and uneventful government with weak ministers, then we have a bigger risk. They are actually the ones running the bigger risk right now. Because Chega has still a lot of electoral potential. We cannot deny this. And this is our perspective. Regarding the choices of both PSD and the PS, that's up to them. We think it's actually positive that we have a parliament that's actually determining the outcome of different policies. Negotiations will be very important. Every vote will matter. Every MP will matter. And I guess we'll see some more of cross-partisan negotiation across different measures. I think that's healthy. So I think it's good that parliament is more important now, and this is the most fragmented parliament we've ever had. And this will be interesting times.
That is certainly very interesting, because it would mean that Portugal would move from a country that has so far had a government that had an absolute majority in parliament to potentially a minority government, which I know there's countries such as Belgium and the Netherlands that they always talk about this, but they never actually want to do it. It's always coalitions in the end. And moving to a sort of the Danish model of a minority government is certainly validates the role of parliament. But you mentioned Shega, the far right party. Is that actually a parliamentary party that has the capacity of this kind of compromise building and parliamentary work? Do you see that, or is it really just a protest vote party?
That's up to them. As far as I know, and I know their work, you know, I follow their work quite closely, being working in parliament. So I know what kind of proposals they put out, and they have all kinds of, from very stupid to pretty normal ideas about what should be done. So if you look at their proposals on healthcare, they're okay. But once you get into other territories, especially in environmental stuff, agriculture, etc., they're pretty bad. And then very populist regarding some professional classes, right? They want to award all kinds of benefits to everyone, you know, firemen, nurses, policemen, and all those professional classes. They have a very clear policy of trying to capture those professional classes. I think they will focus on doing those things so they can hold on to QE voters. And so the government has a responsibility of trying to, you know, juggle these demands. Shega will need to grow as a party, right? They had very low quality output in parliamentary terms. They had the biggest number of proposals, both for the budget and for parliament itself, because they want to show that they're doing a lot of work and they work hard. Many of them had, you know, basic, you know, typing errors, grammar errors. One of the biggest, one not a big scandal, but it was a small scandal that happened, was they actually copied a proposal from the left bloc, but forgot to change the logo at the end of the page. And so we had Shega proposing a bill with the logo of the left bloc party at the end of the page. So this is the kind of work we had to deal with. Now they have more money and more resources, so maybe they can hire some good people to actually do their job.
Well, I love that little anecdote. And for the until now ruling Socialist Party, do you think there will be a reckoning and understanding towards this result, or will it be more pushing this on, the far right is responsible and people are bigoted, or do you think there will be an understanding and personnel changes that come with it?
I think there are good signs actually coming from the Socialist Party. The leader of the Socialists, unexpectedly, I should say, in the election night, had a very, you know, pretty clear-minded and sober stance on this, and he was very clear about one thing: we don't have 1 million fascists in Portugal. This is one of the claims he made in the election night. And I think that was positive, because you cannot just exclude 1 million voters outright. We have around 10 million voters in the country. 6 million, but 10 million people in the country. You cannot just exclude 1 million voters from the picture. And so we need to understand what's going on in those regions, especially in the south. Algarve is a district where Shega actually won. They won a district. And so we need to pay very close attention.
What do you think going forward now, and sort of we'll have to close on this because of time constraints, in the immediate, what are the most pressing issues for Portugal going forward in the next few months? What will a new parliament have to deal with immediately? Budgetary concerns, infrastructure, what is sort of for you the most important one, especially because there will be a secondary test for whatever government and parliament comes out of this, because there's European elections also coming up in June. So that will be a first stress test. So up until those European elections, what do you think is the most important issue that a new government will have to work on?
The top of mind issue in Portugal right now is healthcare. The National Health Service is basically collapsing for many different reasons, but we had a lot of professionals leaving over the last years because of uncompetitive pay and going off to, you know, private and social sector. We also have like this deep-rooted inability to manage health units effectively on part of the public system. And right now we have very long waiting lists for surgeries, you know, years-long lists, very long lists to get in to get appointments, which can last for over a year in certain cases. And we have also the lack of family doctors. There's a big chunk of Portuguese people who don't have a family doctor. And so they're basically outside of the system, barring, you know, getting straight into the ER room. And so we've had a boom in ER in the last years. And so we need to fix these things quickly. Also because low-income voters are the ones who are most affected by this. Even though 3.6 million Portuguese people already are using private insurance. So they're paying their healthcare twice. So it's a very dysfunctional system. But low-income voters, I would say, are the ones who are feeling the effects of, you know, the collapse of the National Health Service. And this might be one of the reasons why they're so angry as well. So this is something that needs to be taken care of. People need to see a sign that this year that we're getting back on the right track.
Well, Jorge, thank you so much for joining the Consumer Podcast.
Thank you.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. You can follow Jorge Tejera on X at JME Tejera, which you can also find in the show notes of this episode, and follow the Consumer Choice Center as well on X at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, and I'll see you Thursday.